Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
This is Darren Doctorman, and we are the Inglorious Trexperts.
I thought it was a classic femme fatale.
So much fun.
I like that Shakespearean lace in your acting.
I said, Gene, what do you want from this character?
I want you to just take the character and make it your own.
I had a good time on the film.
On day one, the movie was already $15 million over budget.
We started this movie without an ending. That's like painting yourself into a corner.
I don't think we've ever had a Star Trek captain on our show.
Being, as you said, number one on the call sheet, it is a producer's position if you're going to take it seriously. I was so glad they didn't cast me as Lorca.
You famously wrote that script in 12 days.
On one level, I wrote the script. And on another level, the story was written by everybody and his brother.
Well, I was going to say, what was your response when you were directing and Terry, you know, sort of called you aside and said, hey, I want you to get back in front of the camera again.
I said, he sort of chummed the water a little bit. Are you ready to play Riker? What I thought was saying was, you better go to the gym and lose some weight. Climbs. Are you going to trim your beard? Don't cut your hair. You know, my interest was totally piqued. It's not hyperbole to say it's the best Riker material I've ever had.
New episodes available every Thursday wherever you listen to podcasts. Or subscribe today at TrekSportsPlus.com. But keep on trekking, ingloriously, of course. If you haven't subscribed to TrekSports Plus yet, you're missing out on some really great interviews, commentary, and shows. And here's a sneak preview of our recent conversation with Sarah Douglas.
Ooh.
I want to know more about what these perversions were.
Or the unreasoning hatred. Start with either of them, honestly.
I think the hatred was the short cropped wig that I was wearing and the tight boots and the eyebrows that were stuck up with glue and the white makeup that they put on me to cover my freckles because supervillains didn't have freckles.
Right.
So I started the day mean.
Right.
And then it just got meaner.
And the hula hoops couldn't have helped. No. Yeah, how did you maintain the hula hoops for that entire scene?
Wasn't it amazing? I'll tell you what was amazing is my feet were on fire. There was that incredible light underneath.
Right.
I don't know how many megawatts shining up to make us look the three villains at the beginning so wonderfully evil. But yeah. The glass was absolutely red hot. And we had on, contrary to popular opinion, who say I was wearing leather boots, of course they were kind of PVC, plasticky, yucky,
sticky,
got too hotty, not nicey. But we remained, of course, in character, because that's what is expected of you. But it wasn't difficult. It wasn't difficult when you are dressed in such a way. And I, you know, I look at it now and I think, wow, not bad, sir, because it is like it's a different person and it's like embodying somebody. And the number of people that I have said, I was wearing a wig, and they go, I said, yes, my hair was, I just finished The People That Time Forgot.
Sure.
I finished on the Wednesday, and I'd been off in the Canary Islands with the lovely late Doug McClure and Patrick Wayne, and I had long hair then. So if anybody looks, they could see that I had long hair. And on the Wednesday, I finished that, and on the Thursday, I started Superman.
And they stuffed it all in the wig.
Nobody ever said, cut your hair.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, that's what's so amazing. It was back in the day. I mean, nowadays, if you go in to meet directors and you're not blonde or you're not dark or you're not what they want, you don't get the job.
Right. That's exactly what I've experienced. It's like just again and again.
But it's absolutely true. The idea of actually, you know, nowadays they want you exactly the way they conceive you. But I mean, I can honestly say, and I think you'll probably all agree, that when I took my wig off and I had my long hair, I was just, I've never been a regular girl, I have to say. But I was kind of as regular as you can be.
Yeah.
Well, if you enjoyed Ashley and Darren's interview with Sarah Douglas from Planet Houston, there's a lot more of that. And you can listen at TrekSportsPlus.com. That's TrekSportsPlus.com. Go there and sign up, and you'll get bonus episodes of Deck 78 to complete your Inglorious Treksports collection.
And tell them you want more Altman free entertainment.
Ha ha! Don't miss a single episode at TrekSportsPlus.com.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
And this is Darren Doctorman.
And this is Ashley Miller.
And we are the Inglorious
Trekksperts. And today, we're going back to the 25th century. I'm not talking about Buck, Wilma, and Dr. Hewer, but we are going back to the land of Star Trek Picard with production designer Dave Blass. And we wanted to have Dave on the show for a while, but it really felt better to have Dave come after the show was over.
Yeah, so that he would be free to share all of the stories.
Fun stuff. Yeah,
I think he'll be a great guest. And obviously, a big part of that is the construction of the Enterprise D recreation, which it just meant so much to so many of us, seeing that on screen. And, you know, of course, we all, you know, have a connection, you know, Darren having spent time there. For me, I mean, I had been on the set in, what was it, 87, I guess, when I was there, you know, during the Farpoint era. And it's just so amazing. I didn't even realize, because obviously I have a special connection to the original bridge, but seeing it again on screen was really, it meant a lot. And you know, also the fact that I remember when I was there to cover Next Gen back in 87 on the set of Too Short a Season, the first time I ever saw the new Enterprise was Mike Okuda gave me, I had no idea who the freak Mike Okuda was at the time. Nobody else did either. And he gave me a tour of the sets. I said, oh, what a lovely guy. And I only found out recently that Mike put me on the LCARS panel on the bridge, my initials, MALT, M-A-L-T, as one of the buttons on the, and I was so touched. I got to tell you.
You were touched many times, apparently. You were a button.
No. I was, yeah, that's funny. I got tears in my eyes. It meant so much to me. And, you know, to be, you know, immortalized on that bridge. And I especially given all the history that I have with this franchise, you know, going back, you know, to the very beginning. This goes back to the beginning. And, It was really, I was really touched by it. And it was a very, very sweet. And I always cherish being a button. I said, I hope it's the phasers, though. they are. Anyway.
I've never seen it, but I'm told that I'm a button on the Voyager bridge.
Oh, but that's nice.
No one's ever going to see that again. So
you're not going to listen to high def.
Yeah.
I've never been a button. And yet.
Oh, you know, you're a button.
I'm totally a button. I have to say that, you know, the D,
it was a button.
Never my favorite Enterprise, but I cannot deny like the emotional impact of seeing her light up and take off and kick ass again in a way that we never ever got to see.
Yeah,
in the Next Generation, just powerful. And I don't think any other version of the ship for the Next Generation in that Next Generation era would have had that same impact.
Oh, but it's the same with the original. You know, the bridges in 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, they're fine, but none of them mean what the original meant, bridge. Maybe the motion picture, but it really is the original bridge that means the most, I think, to all of us. And of course, that's all captured in that wonderful Otoy video that we talked about, which we'll have them on the show soon. Jules, to talk about that. But that was really extraordinary, that tour through all the Enterprise bridges and virtual reality, recreating them. And if you haven't checked that out, you should go to otoy.com. But I have to say, you know, what I love about Dave is Dave is a huge Star Trek fan, much like Terry. And you can just, it's not a secret. That's why the season is so good. People who love and know Star Trek making Star Trek. That's who you hire to do Star Trek. The love is in there, right? It's baked in.
You don't hire people who are embarrassed to be involved in a Star Trek show.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or at least you should feel they need to change it so that they're not embarrassed anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, I mean, they just embraced it, and that's wonderful. And I hope we'll get to see Dave work on Star Trek again in the future, because I think he's somebody who really gets it.
Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. So, and I imagine that was a special moment taking Herman Zimmerman to the Bridge of the D when they surprised him with the recreation of that set. During production, the Herman Zimmerman, who was a production designer on the original Star Trek. Although I was always a big fan of Richard James, I got to say.
Sure.
Who worked on the original Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, his history with Galactica as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to bring Dave in?
I think that'd be a good idea. I want to see how you did when you worked on Picard. I want to see what he says about you.
I bet he's got opinions.
Okay, let's beam in production designer Dave Blass, production designer for season 2 and season 3 of Star Trek Picard. So here we are with Dave Blass. Welcome to the podcast, Dave.
So excited to be here. It's like it's a thing for me because I'm a Trek fan, and it's that whole thing of that for years and even up until now. There's this whole Trek war that's going on, and I'm just not cool enough to. Even though we were making the show, no one had seen what we did. No one knew who I was. So I'm like, I do Star Trek, and they're like, Yeah, I'm sure you do. And now that the show's come out, and it's like, hi, and everyone, oh my god, you're like, hi. I'm like, yes, I'm the guy.
There's still the below the line problems that we face every day.
Oh yeah.
Well, I don't know. I got to tell you, we have gotten pitched, without naming names, a lot of people from the various shows, and we're very picky about who we put on there. We passed on a bunch of people for a variety of reasons, but we're such a fan of your work on obviously Picard season 3 and season 2 that we had to have you on the show. And of course you've been very good to our little friend Darren over here as well, so that is and allowed him to cut school to go to his little Star Trek the motion picture project, so we appreciate that. But I want to before we get into all the Star Trek goodness, and we know you're a fan, anyone who's still on Twitter knows the fact that Dave Blass is a huge Star Trek fan, but a giant advocate for the show, also just has a really good attitude about it. But I want to go back because you look at, you know, Roger Corman gets a lot of credit for the people he brought to the business, like the Scorsese and Ron Howard as a director, and James Cameron. But he doesn't realize that as low budget as those projects were, they provide an incredible point of entry for a lot of people. And one thing people don't realize is that it's harder to do things in your world, in our world, with no budget, low budget, than it is to have all the money in the world. And of course, you started doing things like the Black Scorpion TV series and some other, you know, lower budget, no budget projects. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of breaking in and working in that world before we make the jump to maybe higher budget, which still is not enough, but at least had a little bit more money?
Well, it started out when you're coming out to Hollywood, or at least that's the way it used to be, is that there was no real path to getting in the door. I mean, I used to sneak onto the Paramount lot, and I had all these great tricks to sneak on the lot. And it's like, I think it was a scene from the Ron Howard movie, The Paper. And Michael Keaton says, you can get anywhere in life with a clipboard and a wave. Another one, great one is a ladder. Walk in somewhere with a ladder and no one's going to stop you because you clearly, and it's like, and they just look at you like, okay. And I would go in and I remember dropping off resumes to Star Trek. And this was in the early 90s and they just, no. Because you would mail stuff and get nothing. So the only way to get in was at that time, the low budget film world. And there was Blockbuster and all that stuff that was still a thing. So, Roger Corman was the biggest game in town because they had a lot of work. You would go from one movie to another movie to another movie. So, but going in as a designer, was really tough. So I was doing a movie called Asylum with Robert Patrick and Malcolm McDowell. Mm-hmm. And we were shooting at Lacey Street Studios and I was painting my own sets. We had this like tower. It was like a air shaft tunnel that Malcolm McDowell would crawl around in. And I was painting it and literally the dumb thing, and you're using an airless sprayer, shooting it up to paint the thing, which is not a good idea because what goes up comes down. So I'm like covered in black paint. And as I walk out and this woman approaches me and the guy who ran the studio introduces, she's like, oh, this is Marta Mobley. She runs, Roger Corman's studio. And I'm just covered in black paint. And I'm like, take my glasses off where I look like a raccoon. And she's like, you're the production designer. I'm like, yep. And she goes, "You're the guy we need because our production designer never leaves the office, and you're out here on, you know, thing." And I got hired, and I went and did things. About 8 or 10 movies for Roger, and then the Black Scorpion TV series, and then they tore the studio down. So I was there right up until the very end.
Not Lazy Street. They tore down Roger's studio right on Abbot Kinney.
Yeah, that was the one. People were like, "Well, how do you pick your colors for your set?" I'm like, I would go to Home Depot, look at all the returned paints. I'm like, there's like 6 gallons in greenish shades. And I'd take those, and I had a 5-gallon bucket back at the studio. I'd dump them all in, mix them up, and I go, "That's the color of the set."
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so funny because you hear, you know, DPs are always talking. So I'd rifle for short ends so we'd have enough, you know, film to shoot. And to hear you talk about looking for the paint that was returned is pretty funny.
But it's a thing that if you do that and you start out with that mentality, it doesn't leave you. And it's amazing how so many people now coming into the business, they don't have that gear. Yeah. It's all like, "Oh, we have to 3D print something." I'm like, "Well, no, go down to, you know, the irrigation department at Home Depot and find a bunch of things that look like something, spray paint them silver." And they're like, "What do you mean? Give me a drawing and we'll do it." And I'm like, "Nope, just figure it out." And so we had, you know, and again, we did that on the Shrike, because that was the Shrike in season 3 was a Roger Corman set. They're like, "Here you go. We have no money. We've run out of money, space, time, everything, but we need a bad guy ship." And I'm like, "Okay, we don't have any space. There's no stages left. There's no..." And I'm like, "Okay." And I'm walking around the lot going, "What am I not... what corner can I put it in?"
And we're all out of milk crates.
Yeah. And I'm just like looking at it going, "Okay, we're not using the... we're shooting a lot of stuff up above on the La Serena, but nothing down below. Okay, maybe I could do this and that. And all right, we'll figure it out." And then I used this trick that I picked up doing when I used to do game shows and stuff, where we took a window screen, crinkled it up, and then you bring it back, and then you uplight it, and it gives it this weird kind of metallic different look. And that's what we use behind the screens in the Shrike. And I'm like, people are like, "Okay, window screen?" I'm like, "Trust me, it's going to work." And people are like, it's not going to work. I'm like, "It's going to work." And they're like, "It's not going to work." I'm like, "Dude, it worked on The Biggest Loser. It'll work on this."
You know, that's so funny, Dave, because, you know, now there's this attitude among a lot of people. It's like they want to start, whether, you know, running a studio or directing a movie, having the top job, right? But wouldn't you say you learn so much working on the crap gigs? I mean, here you're talking about working reality. I mean, I'm sure working on Beauty and the Geek in some way prepares you for Picard 20 years later. But the fact is, it's like you need those tools to build on. You don't just come out fully hatched and know how to do everything and could do your best work. It's those 20 years working your way up the ladder where you pick up all these tricks.
Yeah. And you always have that thing where like someone's going to tell you like, "Oh, you know, you can't do that." And I'm like, but you can. And like, we ran into that with the turbo lift doors. So it's like, I wanted this particular paint finish on them. I'm like, I wanted to put like carbon fiber and then like a candy apple red over it, so you have like texture. And they're like, "Oh, you can't do that." I'm like, "But you can." And they're like, "But you can." I'm like, then I go home, literally bring in the piece that I had painted myself. I'm like, "But you can." So, and it's like, you know, it's that thing that once people realize, it's like, "Oh, you actually know your stuff," then they're more likely to, you know, go with your crazy idea.
Well, so what you're saying is you have to understand how things work on a starship.
Yes.
It's hard enough explaining this stuff to people in your department.
Yeah.
Let alone people who have no connection with it whatsoever. So that's, you know, that's a good 3/4 of the job sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, Star Trek is hard because one of the things people don't get is there's not this like room full of artists sitting there waiting for the Star Trek job to start. And then they all, you know, because people are like, "Oh, well, I hope the new Star Trek Legacy gets going and you guys all get to go." And I'm like, "I hope I get a job." It's like, yeah, right. You know, it's like, we're not, it's like if Legacy goes, it may be a year down the line or something. I'm like, I hope that's not, you know. And, you know, it came into play with Star Trek Picard season 2. Because my first thing was, it's like, "Hey, let's get the band back together." I called Mike Okuda, I called Doug Drexler, and well, Mike's on For All Mankind. Doug's doing Orville.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, okay. So the guys that I want to hire are not available. So then you get guys who are really talented artists and things, but they're not the Star Trek guys. And they're putting keyboards on, you know, the consoles. And I'm like, nope, we're not doing keyboards.
I'm sorry. That was one time. Okay. Just
yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you get the really perfect guy and he goes off to remaster one of the greatest movies of all time. So,
well, you know,
we all who get would that be?
Well, I've got to ask you because, I mean, obviously you were coming off some, you know, really big shows with some, you know, healthy budgets. And, but I'd love to know when season one, after season one, they were looking for a new production designer on Picard. What was that meeting like? Because it was right before COVID, right? If I'm not mistaken. And so I don't, you know, was it your agent called you or how did this, and tell us about that first meeting and, you know, how you ended up getting the gig.
Well, it worked out great because I had done a show called Justified, and we were up in Santa Clarita Studios for forever. And then I got hired on by some people who did Justified to do a show for Marvel called Ghost Rider. And we were also shooting at Santa Clarita Studios, and we were on it for long enough that the show took place on a farm, a corn farm. We planted 10 acres of corn. It grew 10 feet tall, and then they pulled the plug. So, and we were renting stage at Santa Clarita Studios. So I knew the head of production up there, and he kind of put in a word. And I had met previously with the folks to do Discovery Season 3. So I was in the group of people to call. And then, you know, I went in and met with them. I'm like, okay, this, because they were, you know, and also we had lent Picard our stages. So I knew some of the Picard people from them coming down. Can we use your stage? I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, they're not letting me build sets for Ghost Rider. But so I was in Santa Clarita, in town, our Star Trek guy. So my agent did give me the meeting. I went in there and then I met Terry Metalis, amazing guy. But we also shared the thing that we both went to Emerson College around the same time. I think he was a little after me. But we had the same film teachers. It was like our main film teacher. He had two sons, and I was friends with him. We all played soccer together. Terry was also a really good friend. So we're like, oh, we had this bonding thing. And I'm like, you know, showing him this massive presentation I put together. I'm like, listen, you need someone who knows Star Trek. You don't want to walk into a Star Trek show with a bunch of people that you have to teach because you don't have the time to teach them. And you don't want to get blindsided by, you know, the fact that they don't know what they don't know. And, you know, you get into it. And I said, you know, looking at season one, you guys did great stuff because it's also very different than Star Trek. There's not a lot of, you know, Federation starships. There's not a lot of this. So you were able to go off and do your own thing, which was a lot of what season two was. But also season two was going to be, you know, present day. So that, you know, there was that type of thing. I'm like, I do present day LA really well. So it was really exciting. And then, you know, I got it. And then it was also the first time in forever that we did 20 episodes of Star Trek in one shot. So it wasn't like, you know, Discovery or Strange New Worlds or whatever, when they've been doing 10 and 10. We had, you know, we finished season two on a Friday, started season three on a Monday. So that was and then add a little, you know, COVID pandemic in there for good measures. It was a little bit challenging.
Yeah, that's something a lot of people don't realize is that two and three, you know, were filmed back to back, like the old 26 episodes of Next Gen. Just the fact that, you know, the show was greenlit, these were going to be his last two seasons. And I think what I'm in awe of, and I'm sure Ashley, you would agree, is how you were able, you know, knowing you had the two seasons, to know what you could build for season two and reuse for season three, you know, what your standing sets will be. Because people don't realize, you know, they think, oh, Star Trek and now on Paramount, it's a different world. Unlike the old show, they have all this money and da da da. Well, you don't, particularly when you have the kind of above the line you're dealing with on season three, bringing back the whole cast. And I just think it was so ingenious, the way you were able to reuse, you know, certain sets. And obviously, the amazing thing, and we've said this to Terry, is that season three is almost, until the very end, a bottle show. It almost is all on, but it never feels that way. It never feels small, and it feels intimate, but it never feels small or claustrophobic. And that's a testament to Terry and you and what a fantastic job you did. Can you talk to us a little bit about the approach? Because obviously what you could do also affected what the writers could write, because you can write it, but if you can't afford to build it, you can't shoot it.
Yeah, I mean, I couple of things. Like going into the whole thing, we had no idea. So the idea that we knew in season two what season three was going to be, absolutely. You know, we built the in season two we designed and built the Stargazer, and we knew that from the jump, because of the amount of time it would take to build, that everything in episode one was shot in episode, because they kind of bookends. It's like you see the Stargazer in episode one, it comes back in episode 10. So we shot all that during episode 10, which makes sense and everything, except for one minor thing. Episode 10 was the last episode, and then the next episode, which would be 11 or whatever, we're now on the Titan. Right. So literally we had barely finished the Stargazer, and then all of a sudden it's the Titan. And it's like, oh, well, it's the same bridge. But I'm like, it's not the same graphics. It's not the same, all this stuff. And then, you know, we didn't really have enough time to shoot the Stargazer and realize, oh, here's where we could improve it and everything, because we were shooting Stargazer like on a Tuesday. And then the following Thursday, we were shooting the Titan. So there was, I mean, literally not enough time to polish the floors.
But you're the one guy who could probably say, well, you know, this is like what they did on Star Trek II. They turned the Enterprise into the Reliant.
Well, you know, and that's the thing is that we did that. And that's why you see at the end the Enterprise G, or I'm sorry, the Enterprise F, where with that when we have the blue, the view screenshot. Right. And it's like, okay, well, that obviously that's the, but I'm like, we had like way more involved, like changeovers. I'm like, okay, we did this, do this, this. And they're like, dude, you got 6 hours. It's like, yeah, you know, whatever. But that was the thing. It's like, when, you know, changing the La Serena into the Shrike and changing this into that. But it's like that you just get into that mode and people adapt to it. And it's like a lot of, you know, it's like Terry gets on me. It's like if I say, oh, we changed that into that. And he's like, no, don't tell people. Because I said it in one of the interviews. I said, that we changed the La Serena into the Shrike. And he's like, yeah, if you didn't say that, no one would notice. I'm like,
yeah, that's true.
That just makes it better.
Yeah. So I think that was the thing. We, you know, it's funny going back through, you know, like your iPhone and your memories and different things and like meetings that we're having. But I'm having meetings of, you know, Picard running around in the basement with Borg chasing him in the chateau. At the same time, we're having Titan design models, and you know, so we were literally designing two seasons at the same thing, because you know, everyone else kind of sees it as two different chunks. Oh, there was season two, and then, but it was like, you know, and then there was this big shift. I'm like, well, the big shift was over a weekend,
yeah.
But you know, Terry had left season two to go and focus on writing, so it was like towards the end of that. But you know, then he just kind of brings me in the office and he's like, okay, here's what we're thinking. And we needed this, we needed this, we needed this, we needed this, we needed this. And I'm like, okay, that's a lot of stuff. I mean, it's like, it's a bottle episode, except we didn't have a bottle because there was, you know, there was no transporter room. There was no sick bay. There was no crew quarters. There was no nacelle room. There was no, you know, all these things, and then all, you know, the additional, you know, it's just within the first episode, you know, we had the Titan, we had the new space dock, we had the Shrike, we had Ilios, and it's all these things, you know, new things are designed for season three, and we are still literally dealing with the launch of the whatever it was, shipping. It's like, you know, running around, and that was the other challenge, is that season two is a lot of locations.
Yeah.
So we would be out scouting and doing all that stuff and looking for a place to do the launch facility. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, you know, all this pandemonium. And then at some point, Terry goes, oh, by the way, we're going to want the Enterprise D back. And it's like, right. Oh. Okay.
What was, I mean, because as a fan, I'm sure you're like, oh my God, this is incredible. That would be amazing to bring that back, you know, after all these years, and how it's going to resonate and what it means to you and what it means to the fans. But as a production hire to say,
yeah. Yeah. It's like that, the, you know, the Captain Kirk dual thoughts of like, I'm good Kirk. Oh my God, that's so awesome. Bad Kirk, you're going to fuck this up. And it's like, you know, it's like, you know, that was always my thing with Star Trek, you know, it's doing it is, you know, when, and people hate me because of this, because I'm like, I came from a tiny town in Massachusetts and I left to go to Hollywood to work on Star Trek and design, be the guy that designed spaceships. And everyone's like, okay, you're an idiot, but that's not like a logical, smart goal. I'm like, okay, just tell me I can't do it one more time. And then I actually did it. And it's like, people are so, like, people that grew up with, they're like, oh, that's so, because, you know, you went and go and, because so many people, like, they don't know what they want to do in life. They don't, the thing. And it's like, and to come up with something that, like, that, that you actually want to do, and then go and be able to do it. And, but my thing was, okay, finally, I got the job. I'm like, what if I screw it up?
Yeah.
And that was what, that was the Enterprise D, which was, okay, if we're going to do this, I already know that it has to be a museum quality replica. And I think that, you know, a lot of the upper brass, Terry was a fan and he'd been there, but I think people didn't get, because season one was so different and there wasn't a lot of like, oh, look at that thing, that's wrong, because everything was new, everything was different. And The Lost Serpent, it was really cool, but you couldn't really nitpick it because it's something completely new and different. But I'm like, they will get on every single thing. So if we're going to do it, we have to do it exactly right. And everyone's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then once we got into it, people, so we had this giant board that Liz had created. Liz was the main art director on that set. And it was our wall of inspiration. It was like frame captures and photos where you could see this was this. And we put it right on the set so that anyone walking on the stage could see the level of detail we were trying to get to. And you know, we had noted every single thing. It's like, oh, here's the set from Vegas, because we had everyone saying, well, why don't we just use one of the old Vegas sets? And I'm like, because they're not accurate. I mean, you look at this and you look at this, completely different. Yeah. And it's like, okay. And so then once we get into it, all the carpenters and the painters and everyone got really excited because they realized our level of thing there, and it became a thing of how close can we get it. And you know, I always point to the idea of the horseshoe and the wood graining, and the painters just literally studied the wood graining and, wow, and how where the knot was and how it lined up and how many things or how many grains were on it, and they just nailed it. But that all came from us getting so excited about doing it properly, and then bringing back, you know, having Mike there and saying, oh, we're gonna create a vignette around the L cars because the way that the fluorescent lights, and we just went next level on it, and everyone really got into it, and that was kind of the fun part of it.
What's crazy is that a set like that is normally amortized over the cost of a whole season. You build it for your first episode, and then basically your pattern budget absorbs the cost. You had to do it for one season. You're building like,
well,
the
we
most,
had to do it for two
for
two
one episode for two episodes, right?
Yeah. So that's why when people say, "Oh, it's basically a bottle show," I go, on ships that didn't exist, and you know, it's like. You know, it's like, in addition, oh, it's a bottle episode, except for the giant alien town we built.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a bottle with a jewel encrusted cap.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's that thing of going, you know, everyone did such a great job hiding our changeovers and things. But it's like, I mean, there's one thing. And again, people will figure this one out. Like, obviously, there was one crew quarters, but there's a scene in the finale, and I think it's just a great example of, if everyone does their job, the audience doesn't care, because we cut directly from a scene with Troy and Data in the crew quarters to Raffi and Worf in the crew quarters.
Right.
And it's the same room, and you cut directly from one to another. Mm-hmm. Nothing in between.
No redress?
No, it was redressed, but it was like, to the extent that you can redress, mm-hmm, you know, a box.
Yeah.
But it was shot different. The lighting was a little different, but you're But they were shot in the same day. It was literally like, okay, go away for an hour, change the furniture and come back. But you don't notice it. You just change the angle. You do a little something, and it is something completely different. And Terry did this great flop where he shot this way and then moved the furniture and then shot that way again. So it looks like there's windows at both sides of the room or something. But, you know, again, you can do so much and the audience will go with you. If the story is good and you're getting them hooked on that.
Yeah, but Dave, you also come from a tradition that knows the salt shaker is a hypo, right? You come from that. Yeah. You have the knowledge of how Star Trek did things in the past. Like, oh, you know, they turned the salt shaker into a hypo spray, right? So now the whole attitude with like Game of Thrones is we have to build everything. Everything's from scratch. Everything is this elaborate, you know, we need a $17 million budget to do television today for prestige TV. But, you know, you're thinking in a classic way that goes back to your roots in Roger Corman.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the biggest things, and it was a little bit of a hurdle, but I just went with it. I'm like, no, this is what we're doing. Shut up and go away. Was what I call the space crates, which was the ceiling panels that they used in everything in Next Generation. It was this fiberglass grating and they used them on the ceiling, they used them on the floor, they used them on the walls, and it's just this kind of open mesh grating thing. And it was just, I mean, they would like cut them up and build furniture on it, and it was just everywhere.
They were originally used by the post office to stack boxes and things.
Well, and that was a season two thing, and it was like, I had asked, I'm like, okay, I want this stuff. And they're like, oh, I don't know where to get it. And then I go, figure it out. I want it. And I went all of season two not getting that. And then in season three, I'm like, I hit it. And then Liz was like, oh, yeah, I didn't know that. Those are freezer pallets. I'm like, what? And she's like, yeah, here's the thing. I'm like, $65. I'm like, I want them. And she's like, how many? I'm like, all of them. I go, how many can you get? And I said, I'm going to put them on everything. And then, you know, we get him in and I'm like, oh, we're going to use this. And lighting guys are like, we got to do a camera test. And I'm like, why? And they're like, well, everyone's kind of concerned about how they're going to look. I go, have you seen Next Generation? They'll look like that. And we used throughout the season, they're everywhere. They're in like Daystrom Station. They're this. And it just became that thing where everyone kind of got into the, oh, it doesn't matter if you used it in that other set. You can use it in this set. I go, yeah, it's
in universe.
This is space drywall. Yeah. It's everywhere. It's like, you know, and you can use it. And then once people started getting into that, they really found out. And Kit Stolson, he was the other. He did District 6. He did Daystrom. He did. So it kind of had like teams of people. But he was coming off of Orville. And where they were, you know, and I joke, I think Orville's amazing and does some just beautiful work. But it's like, you know, he was coming off the cover band and I'm like, oh, now you get to come to, you know, play with the real band. But they had already figured it out. They're like, you know, they can lean into that design aesthetic. And he had a great look and he brought so much of that stuff. But literally District 6, because we knew where that we had to spend the money where the money had to be spent, like on all the presets. But then we go to District 6, it's like, oh, it's this cornucopia of stuff that's just going to be seen in lights and shadows. So we just went to our scene doctor and said, just take all that shit out to the desert, put one thing onto it. It's like, oh, that's a Borg alcove, painted gray and things, and everything got reused. And you know, it's, at some point I'll do a video where I point to it, like, oh, yeah, that's this, that's that. That's the alcove that the Borg Queen came up from at Disney, and it's just, we just reused everything, and you know, it worked out great. So
was there ever a moment that you looked at Terry and you just said, nope, can't, you're nuts, you're a whole bag of cashews, man?
No, because you know, it said, well, actually I think I said it once when he said, oh, we're gonna do the Titan, and I'm like, but we just built the Stargazer. and I'm like, you're gonna. And he's like, no, we're doing this. And I'm like, okay. But no, he's coming into it from a thing. He's like, here's what I want to do. I don't know how to do it. It's like with Daystrom. He goes, it's like you know, Indiana Jones last scene, walking around with all the crates, and each place you walk in has something, and there's a bit of a chase scene, and figure it out. And he's like, do we do it on La Serena? Do we do this? Do we do that? And, you know, he kind of here, come up with a plan, and you know, and then we would kind of do it. But and then as far as like, you know, the Enterprise goes, it's like he's like, I need the Enterprise D, it needs to be perfect.
But other than that, no pressure.
Yeah. But we had, you know, like I said, he would never ever like come to me like with one of our redresses and go, dude. And I'm like, because he knew, he's like, he was under the same constraints. He's like, he has big cast. He wants to bring these actors back. He has to do this thing. So it's like, he's just like, figure it out, come in on budget and, or spend no, you know, whatever we can do to get the things done. It's like, okay. So it's like, you know, oh, okay. The nacelle room became the environmental systems room. We had, again, the towers, we made them out of the space crate. And I'm like, yeah, but that looks like, you know, and it's like, oh, there's four in this set and there's five in this set. And it's like, oh, okay. It's a different set. They're blue in this one. And they're
orange. There are four towers.
But yeah, it's like, you know, we had like the nacelle room and I had this grand vision to remake it like the episode Eye of the Beholder, where they had the cell room and you crawled up the ladder and there's the view out the thing. And I'm like, you know what, we drew it all up and you know, we budget it and they're like, oh, that's not gonna happen. But I put a window there. I'm like, okay, here's a window for like half the scene, it will be open and we can see into the cells. And they're like, no, you can't do that. I'm like, okay, window closed.
Well, I remember when you first were talking about getting this job for season two, because you had hired me on a couple other projects, just, yeah, you know, little things remotely, and I had a great time working with you. And when I heard that you were up for this, I was thinking, oh my God, this is amazing. This is going to be great, because I was already working on Picard season one a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it was so great to have someone like you come in who actually, you know, not only didn't feel a put down for working on a Star Trek show, that it was actually a bonus in your mind. And
oh, yeah.
It was such a great, a great, I'm going to say, change of pace from what was usually happening. So
it was
wonderful.
It bothered me a little bit that's what it was. And it was odd. And I get, you know, and again, I think that the season one is, and again, I will always say this, I think Discovery is a beautiful show. I think everyone doing Star Trek is doing a great job in the world that they're doing in. And I've gone on to podcasts, people like, oh, they don't like it. I go, you know what? All these artists are doing amazing work and their own thing. And it's like, if someone says they want something different, the artists do something different.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's like, if they say the, you know, whereas I would go to some of the artists and go, I want a Star Trek ship, and they would do a Babylon 5 ship, or they'd do a Star Worship. I go, no, it's going to be Star Trek. And it's like getting that design aesthetic that it needs to be this. And I think that we on Picard, or at least in the seasons that I did, had an advantage because there was a direct thread to the Next Generation. We were, as Discovery was doing, we're going to do something completely different.
Yeah.
And we're going to do something this and this. And then season one comes out and the fans are like, whoa, you can't do that. And they're like, but everyone wants something different, not doing the same thing. And you know, that didn't work out. And that's why it's like it's harder. It's like, I would rather do the Stargazer or the Titan than try and redo the Enterprise, the original Enterprise. I go, what a horrible thing to try and, it's like, because no matter what you do, they're gonna hate it.
Yeah,
it's like it's you know, but I think, you know, again, I think Tamara, who did the Enterprise bridge for season two,
yeah,
it works for me on a lot of, and I get what they're trying to do. It's not, you know, but you know, how do you wrangle all that in the world of you know, because we ran into that with in season two, because we went and we had young Picard. And at one point, there was a scene in his bedroom. And I'm like, okay, well, he would have a computer terminal interface, something. It should be Kirk's square iMac-y looking thing, if you track the timeline, worst case scenario, it's that funky laptop that he had on right. his desk, and even that would be super futuristic to Hibbs. I go, but it can't be some hologram thing. I go, so, yeah. And that went into so many, you know, crazy conversations. And, but we did, so, but for season three, Terry was on board with all of my stupid ideas. Like, you know, we had Picard's old computer or so anytime we could go vintage or even more vintage, like we had the boatman's whistle, which was, right. You know, super. So he loved all that stuff. So.
Yeah, well, Terry had brought on a lot of veterans of 12 Monkeys, obviously, yeah. and he felt very comfortable. There was a shorthand with them. You were not a 12 Monkeys veteran, but it sounds like you won him over pretty quickly, that you guys had a shorthand pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I think that for him, it was like he grew up, or I don't want to say grew up. When I was working with Roger Corman, he was working on Star Trek, and the fact that my first call was to Mike and to Doug and to that I had this, you know, and I still look at them, you know, as these gods of Star Trek, and you know, Darren as well. But and people like, oh,
Darren's no god.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, it's like these people who created all the stuff. But it's like, for me, it's that thing, you got to have this appreciation for it, and then I get the hard part where I'm sitting in a meeting with Mike Okuda and Doug Drexler and John Eaves and going, okay, how do I say in a way that is positive and inspiring and great and what an amazing work that, yeah, this just isn't going to work. And it's like, mm-hmm. you're saying, it's like, so I got to be the notes guy. I got to be the guiding force of doing, getting where it's where. And it's working with these guys to bring out the best of them. And I think that's, you know, I seeing that is like, my job I'm the guy playing the orchestra. It's like you have the yeah. best trumpet player in the world, and it's my goal to bring the best out of him by guiding him in the direction and working to find out what Terry wants, what everyone wants, what the DPs want, and then bring it out of the guys. And sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's, you know, it's a challenge.
Well,
the other speaking, thing that, oh, go ahead, Darren.
Speaking of challenges, let's address this whole COVID thing, because we started season two in the offices at Santa Clarita.
Yep.
And, you know, right around March 20th, everything imploded and we had to go home. We were put on hiatus for a couple weeks. But then we came back remotely, and that is not easy at all. Certainly no. for, you know, trying to get stuff built and get stuff designed and talk about that a little bit, because that's an amazing accomplishment, actually.
Yeah, I would say it's probably my biggest regret about the experience is that I brought this team of people together who have this creative energy that is just infectious. And it went from, you know, having John Eaves across the hall from me where I could go in and watch him sketch and steal his sketches when he wasn't looking to everyone's on Zoom.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's and like the whole, you know, get the band back together. The band was never together. And yeah. it was mm-hmm. so hard because then everyone's in their own little zone. And I start out every morning having like a Zoom meeting every morning and going through everyone's work. And so that everyone can see what everyone else is doing. And then, you know, after these hour long meetings, people started coming to me going, and more the people in the working on the sets and everything, they'd be like, yeah, this is sucking up a lot of time, dude. I'm yeah. like, but that's what's important. We got to see. And I have to do it anyway, because I have to see what everyone's doing and talk to everyone. I'm like, I'll do one meeting and that way everyone's involved. But season two was such a location fest that, you know, then I'd jump in a van and go drive around for 4 hours looking yeah. for a field or something. So it was super hard. And again, you didn't get the collaboration. I mean, you know, people say, oh my God, it was so great to work with Mike. And I go, I met Mike, like I met Mike for the first time at the event at the Skirball Center.
Oh, the Star Trek day.
Yeah, Star Trek.
Yeah, day. Yeah.
It was like the first day that I think you were there.
Yep.
It was like the first time like people had were together. And that was about a year after we were together. So
yep.
because of COVID restrictions, you had to test offsite a day before you came in and do all this stuff. And the studio didn't want to pay for it. It was like a whole, and then you had to be like an A zone and B. So it was really challenging. So then it became, you know, everything by Zoom. And it's literally like herding cats, where you could used to be able to walk into the bullpen and look at everyone's work. You now had to like download the box and go to the thing, give the notes, and, you know, and then we all became very proficient on Zoom, and we have all these Zoom meetings with, you know, this group and that group, and you could share your stuff in there, and you know, that which was great. And I still have to at some point go back and go through the Zoom meetings and download them all, because there's all these side conversations and talk that was all the stories that we didn't have on set. But people were like, you know, talking about the Enterprise D. We shot that in March of 2022. You know, famously, there was a big thing in the paper back then. So, but in January, we're coming back from Christmas, 50 people tested positive for COVID. And again, no one was anywhere near the stage. It was that drive-through testing where you go in and you... So, but everyone's like, you know, so it wasn't a danger situation, but it was 50 people are gone for 2 weeks. And then it's that thing of going, okay, so who was that? Oh, that was the painter who was working on the wood graining, or the guy who was sculpting the horseshoe, or the, you know, so, and then they're gone for weeks. And then the whole pod, you know, so then if someone tested positive, that whole pod would go. So it was challenging times to, you know, and then, you know, I have all my behind the scenes photos that I take, and everyone's wearing masks. So again, I have no idea
who they are.
Yeah. And it's, oh yeah. I mean, I run into people, and it's like, if I, you know, luckily I spent so much time with Jonathan Frakes that, but I would run, if I ran into Patrick Stewart on the street, he wouldn't know me from, you know, or any, pretty much anyone on the show. But it was a very weird time to do it. And, definitely not the easiest situation, but like we had one situation where we had all the capsule stickers that we were putting on the Stargazer in the hallway, and I said, because it's not like the old days where Mike and Doug would run down and put them on themselves, as Jeffrey Mandel had created them, and I'm like, okay, well, Jeffrey will tell you where do they go. I'm like, well, they go where they're supposed to go. I'm like, I don't have the bandwidth to tell you where to put stickers. Tell Jeffrey, and Jeffrey's like, well, I can't see. It's something I have to do by feel. And it's like, okay, so we're going to have to clear the stage because Jeffrey's not in the A group that could be on the stage. So we literally had to clear out the entire stage for Jeffrey to come in one day and put stickers on. And that was, and you're just like, yeah. But yeah, it's like Jeffrey, but that's the thing. I have like 8,000 photos on my iPhone with me like putting my finger on a graphic to see the scale, so taking a photo so they could see the scale, because the playback guys weren't on stage. Mike Okuda wasn't on stage. It's like, so all the guys creating the graphics for the screen weren't there to actually look at how it looks on the set. So I'd be like, okay, this font is too small, or this graphic is too small. And they're like, no, look, I'm sure it's good. I'm like, photo click, but it's not. And it's like, if this is an interactive thing, that's like a, you know, 3-point text. And they're like, well, you're not supposed to read it. And then we would have all these curved monitors that, you know, no one had ever done before.
Right.
And we're trying to align a curved projection. And I was just like, I'm like, you know, here, photo finger thing, move this over this. And, yeah. But,
nightmare.
But you know, and you know, it's the thing though, it's like you're sitting there having your worst day, and I remember vividly going, and I'm like, oh my god, they need you to come down set. And it's like, it was like in the 10 forward bar set, and I'm like running down, and I have all these things going on, and they're like, I'm like, what? And they're like, they don't understand why Picard would recognize Sari and Brandy, and why, because it was, he was in the past, he was in our present day, and Guinan has a bottle of Sari and Brandy, and that's the thing that he clocks. And they're like, no one understands why. I'm like, let me explain to Jean-Luc Picard, Patrick Stewart, why Sari and Brandy is an important plot point in the Star Trek universe. This is my bad day. This is what I have to do on my bad day, my irritating or explaining warp core dynamics to people. And, you know,
Be careful what you wish for. You may get it.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting because obviously with the original, Next Gen and through Enterprise, they shot on the Paramount lot, and they had you know, since 1979, flats, props, yep, set dressing, that you could just go and grab, and it helped, you know, with the cost, with the budget, and also with time. You didn't have any of that.
No, and also we didn't have, you know, famously, I remember one of the first things that we talked about, because when I took over, you know, the sets were still up from season one. I walk in and one whole stage was a Borg cube. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. And there were all these like 4 feet by 4 foot by 10, 12, 14 foot towers. I go, okay, here's what I want to do. I want to take those towers, take them down to the construction storage mill, just stack them against the wall. So then the whole room becomes 4 feet smaller, but it was a giant place. It's not, you know, it won't really take up any space. And then we have them in case, and they're like, yeah, but we're never doing the Borg again. And I'm like, oh, but we don't know that. And they're like, no, we're never going to the Borg cube again.
Uh-huh.
Like, we're done. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, but we still have a Borg in the show. She's there. Yeah, they're like, yeah, but she's in her thing. She's in this box, and we're not going. And then at one point, they wrote like an alien ship that could be Borg. And I go, ah, and they're like, no. And then we get to season three, and yeah, but I lost the argument, so they tossed all the Borg stuff. I was like, so we get to season three, and they're like, oh, we need a Borg cube, and I'm like,
go figure. Could have used that stuff. We had storage,
and they're like, yeah, shut up. I think we saved, you know, like, you know, 10 columns or something, and we used everything. So it worked out, because what I tried to do with the Borg cube was to bring back every era. We did again a deep dive into the Borg and how the world changed from Best of Both Worlds through Voyager, First Contact, and how each, you know, and into Picard season one, how each Borg was represented and done. Right. And we said, okay, this is like the super cube, where they went and took from every Borg cube, and it's a salvage cube. It's a, right, you know, so that way it, you know, we do that. And then, and we went and we had the vacuform, that was used on the original Borg kit. We had that remade, and we, you know, used a lot of the architecture from the original stuff. And, so again, I think it worked out really well.
It's the Sanford and Son of Borg cubes.
Yes, exactly.
And it must have been really hard, because, you know, this was interesting in that you wrapped, and this was done so long before it aired, that you kind of, you know, just had to keep quiet about this for a long time before you could even talk about it. And someone who's
year,
so proud of his work and his team's work, to, you know, like a proud papa, you know, you obviously got to finally talk about it. And as you say, now that the show is over, you can talk about pretty much everything. But that must have been difficult as well.
It was weird in a lot of ways, because I mean, the season two started airing right as we wrapped, and it didn't get the reception that season three got. So it was a double thing, because you're sitting there going, you know, famously there was you know, one of the great jokes was everyone was bashing on the fact that the Stargazer had shiny floors and there was no carpet. And you're sitting on this joke that, you know, Picard's going to say, you know what I miss? The carpet. And it's like, but like, we shot, that's like already sitting there in the can on the shelf. And then for a year, people are, you know, sitting there saying they miss the carpet. I'm like, I want to just say that joke, you know, and it's that thing of like, so then season two comes out, it, you know, I thought it was great in a lot of different ways. Other people didn't. A lot of people were extremely harsh about it. I think one of the big things that it was like the worst season of Star Trek ever. So you literally have that, and you're going, how? But knowing that season three, but then at the same time, you're going, is season three good? I hope. I thought season two was good, but clearly it wasn't. But I think we did a lot of different things. We did a lot of that with season three. But maybe that sucks too. I don't know. So then we were all kind of pins and needles waiting for it to hit. And then, you know, then it did. And season two started out, got a really good vibe off the first two episodes, and then, you know, fans turned against it. But season three, the first couple episodes hit, and Terry was, you know, we're all like, well, we'll see if they, you know, stick with it and everything. And it just gets better. And for me, I think episode four is one of the best episodes of Star Trek ever. And it's Riker at his best. It's Jonathan Frakes directing. It's just hitting on all cylinders. And it was just really, you know, so once you kind of got to that point and everyone's like, oh my God. And then it just doesn't really drop off. So I think that that was, so once we got into it and it really started taking off, so that's why I don't think the whole talk of the Star Trek legacy, you know, coming out of season two, there really wasn't like a, hey, let's start talking about the net, you know, a new Picard era spinoff. No one was interested.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until season three. So I think that took a lot of people by surprise, because even though, you know, they had the episodes done and sitting there, I don't know that anyone really clocked how much it was going to resonate with fans. And I think that nostalgia is a brush that you paint with, and Terry painted it like an artist.
Yeah.
And it's like you sit there and you go, you're not slapping it all over the thing just to do it. You're doing it like a musician hitting tones and beats and things. The score, I think, and that's stuff like that was not easy for him to do, because, no. You know, the composer that they had on for season one and season two also does this, very incredibly talented. And it's like, it's that thing of like, you're not, but Terry had someone he worked with, you know, and again, he brought in a lot of his 12 Monkeys people that he was comfortable with, and they did the thing. And again, that's, you know, I think that's what you expect out of a producer or someone who has a vision, and they come in and they execute the vision and they stick to it. And he didn't waver at all. So I think that's a, you know, from the start to the finish to him directing the final two episodes, you know, it was a big thing. And you know, we're really proud of it. I think for me, it's kind of as a career thing, you want to create something as a filmmaker that inspires people, that touches people.
Yeah.
And I have hundreds of emails and people saying, you know, I watched, I was crying. I, you know, it reminded me of watching it with my dad. And this was such a bonding show, and tons. And you sit there and all this stuff, people writing, just pouring their hearts out to you. Thank you. And you're going, that was my goal, to be a filmmaker. It's like to sit there and say, oh yeah, I want to, as a kid, it's like, I want to go to Hollywood and be a filmmaker, do something that's important, that touches people.
And that will endure.
Oh, by the way, I set out to do it with Star Trek. And then to do it with Star Trek.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To sit there and say, oh, okay. Because, you know, you always want to do that. Oh, I want to do a cool show that people really love. And it's like, it's that thing to sit there to go, okay, that 10 episodes of Star Trek was everything we wanted to do. Yeah. And so we just left it on the field. So, you know, pretty proud of that.
Well, that's one of the reasons why you know, season three specifically is so great, because, you know, it's a good show from the beginning,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The writing is great. The characters are great. The new characters are wonderful, and it doesn't feel wrong. It feels like it is a part of the whole. And those last two episodes are just icing on the cake.
Yeah.
And it's not quote fan service. It's acknowledging that there was an existing Star Trek before this.
Well, that's one of the things that I would tell any of my new people, anyone working on the show, because there was a lot of non-Star Trek people. And I said, you need to approach it from this standpoint. Star Trek is not a science fiction fantasy show. It's a historic drama with 60 years of history that happens to take place in outer space.
That's exactly
right. 60 years of history, that it's a historical drama. It's like, here's the history that you need to pull on in order to do this thing. If it was a World War II show, you wouldn't just put a random chair there. You would put a period appropriate chair. Yeah. That's what we need for every single scene. And it's just a certain level of respect. And Sean Aronson was our decorator for season three. She's just like, you know, got it. And it's like, you're like, nope, this has to be this. We watched this episode. This is the lamp that was, and you're like, yep, okay. But, and it's that thing with like Picard's, you know, people like, oh, there's all the Easter eggs in Picard Chateau. I go, no, there's Picard stuff in Picard Chateau, because he's already been established as a character who keeps mementos. He keeps the flute. He keeps the tapestry. All these things he keeps in his ready room. Why would he not have elements of his life? And the same thing, we went back to the family episode and we're like, okay, so there's the plowman sculpture that's seen in like every other shot. I want that. I want this. Remake this little platter thing because we see that on the wall. I want all the that painting, because we're like, in season two, it's like the whole thing is that this chateau is his family. It's his legacy. It's his thing. You want to show that time period. And so really it's, you know, we're seeing Picard as a kid, and we already know that he mentions just like, oh, when I was a kid, I used to make, you know, ships in a bottle. Didn't you ever make a Promillion battle cruiser in a bottle? And everyone's like, no, no, what? And it's like, it's a softball. It's like, it's not an Easter egg. It's like, he said he made them. Why wouldn't you? He's doing something.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really tying all those things back in.
Did you have like a staff nerd who basically went through and annotated all of the scripts and like all the breakdowns and everything so that people knew what to go and look at for reference? Or did you have to keep it in your head?
Not really. We did. We had our internet favorite got Yerk. It's Jorg, I've heard it's pronounced Jorg. And he is like, he's the online guy who points out every little issue of things. And he was one of the first people I reached out to. I said, listen, you're the guy who's going to point out what I do wrong. How about if you help me make it right?
Yeah,
you're brilliant. And he was like, that's so cool. But, you know, obviously he was a researcher, but we'd be on set and I'm like, oh, I need this. He goes, oh, it was in this episode of this thing. And, you know, Picard's
it's like Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
Yeah. York Hillebrand
book that's on the, you know, it's like in his chateau, we had his Shakespeare books, and he's like, oh, it should be on this page for this, because that references this. And I'm like, okay. You know, so all those fun things.
Well, now most important question of the night or the day or whatever it is. So on, we got a great Darren, A to F. Works and plays well with others, Dave. What do you give him, A to F?
Works and play. You know, that again, it's hard. I'm going to have to give him, you know, a B plus, because he wasn't in the office that way. Yeah. That much. Like, you know, it's that thing of going, you know, and I shipped him off. Another one of the fun things is, again, because of the lack of cohesion in the whole show, is that all of a sudden Darren would like show up and I'm like, oh, that's Darren's artwork. And it's like, oh yeah, he's doing props. So it's like, you know, he can pull it. I'm like, oh, that's cool. But sadly, you know, I think my biggest thing on that is that, you know, not getting to sit and work with Darren on a day. So it's like, if he's sketching on something, I see it come across I'm like, oh, that's cool. Or I would see, you know, stuff, everyone would put everything in the Dropbox at the end of the day. And I would spend 2 hours going through everyone's work, give everyone notes. But it was never just because of schedule. It wasn't like sitting there talking with the artist individually for an hour. It's, you know, and a conversation that you could do over their shoulder.
Missed too.
Yeah, it was just, you know, the walking down the hallway and just connecting with everyone, or sitting, you know, and having everyone's ideas shared. And I think that was, it's like one of the things on Stargazer, I think John Eves mentioned it, was we had the windows and the whole idea of connecting the bridge to the observation lounge and seeing out the back. And it was a shot from these motion picture where you look up, and I don't know if it's and Darren would actually know this better than I don't know what set it's in, but you look out and you see the view out the nacelles.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in the officer's lounge. Yeah.
Yeah. We're like, oh, wouldn't that be a cool, if you had that thing and then you could have this whole depth. But it's so hard to do when you're just like literally, you know, running around. And, you know, as I said, while we're developing the Stargazer and doing all that stuff, I'm literally running all over LA looking for, and it's that horrible thing. Like, I want to be doing Starship stuff, but I'm literally looking at alleyways in downtown or looking at, you know, and all this stuff. And you're like, oh, vineyards. And it's like, you know, it's like, can we just go back to the vineyard we shot it? It's like, oh, we're shooting in the middle of, you know, like it was February.
Yeah.
And all the vineyards were dead. So we're like, oh, we got to build a vineyard. And I'm like, we're spending money building a vineyard, not a starship, but a vineyard. And it's like, you know, Well, it's just a kind of one of those things.
I remember
we're
the
gonna
most
give him an incomplete. We're going to give you an incomplete that.
Well, let me just say the most fun I had working on the project was I got to do a few days of working out ideas for Riker and Picard's bunk beds in the crew quarters. And that was so much fun because we, you know, you start out with, you know, pie in the sky things. And we tried to bring a lot of, you know, visual cues from original series and Next Gen and trying to figure out just how this was going to work, you know, for the director to block out what was going to happen. And it was so much fun. And I was very happily surprised to see what finally made it into the show. But it was a fun process to try and go through things that were way too expensive for you to build.
Oh yeah, well I had this grand idea of like I called it the multi-purpose room of this room
exactly
that would move and change from when you move this wall and do this stuff, and then it literally your budgets went do and they're like. Okay, because it was like, okay, we're going to have like a mobile wall that comes out. So you have the upper saucer windows and then you have the lower saucer windows and you just roll out this flat and you can do this. And it just all went, and it's just every day coming in. It's like too much. Yeah. Like, okay, it's this. And, but yeah, you keep, you know, aiming for the stars and
yeah.
You know, but I think, and then in the end, but it was a challenging thing because you know, people would always say, oh, well, don't they have like in a warehouse somewhere? I'm like, no, stop saying that. It hurts my feelings when people like think that. And we would go to the archives and you'd see how little is left. And it's just, you know, little hand props and things.
They sold it all because they were greedy. They sold it all at auction.
Well, they sold all the, but that was all hand props. But there used to be like an entire, you know, I never went there. So, but I hear the story that, oh, all these giant warehouses of all the stuff. And, you know, and you're just sitting there going, all the stuff that you could just pull from that was all it's like, oh, I just need. I mean, I would try. We had, if you go back and watch a show on either side of the turbo lift, are these little tech panels. And I'm like, okay, I need like five different versions of those so I can change them out so it doesn't look like the same corridor every single time. And people were just like, okay, well, what do you want it to look like? I'm like, well, I can draw you a picture, but then we're going to have to custom make the picture. I don't want to have to custom make it. I want it to be reform and, you know, come up with something cool. And, you know, it just became that challenge of getting people to that thing. Whereas before you could just go to the warehouse and pull something off a wall that had, you know, something had been reused and used over again. It's like the cloaking device, the Klingon cloaking device or the Romulan cloaking device that, you know, Captain Kirk has is basically the changeling device,
yeah.
You know, the top of the changeling. It's like, you know, you just take it and move it around and whatever. But, you know, we didn't have that warehouse. We had a lot of season one stuff and it was just, we had all the Borg stuff that we were never going to use.
So when you struck the D, where did it go? Did it go to a dumpster or has it been preserved for posterity?
My understanding of the situation is that it is saved at the archives. So
it's somewhere very safe.
Yeah.
You've got your top.
We have Van working on it.
Is it safe?
Right. John Van Sanders came in and you know, so that was my whole thing with the coming to the end of it. I go, hey, you know, for like months leading up to I knew that it was coming to an end. I'm like, what are we going to do with the stuff? What are we, I, you know, I've got like five starships, you know, I've got the Titan, I've got the Enterprise, I've got, you know, a Borg cube, I've got, you know, all this other stuff, and what are we going to do with it? And we should come up with a plan so we can do it, you know, in an orderly thing. And it's a tick-tock and just time went by and no one wanted to discuss it, and they're like, ah, dumpster. I'm like, but so I organized sending some stuff up, and I still haven't seen what got sent up to Toronto. Cause I'm like, you know, they had talked to, I think some of the producers in Toronto, they're like, it's the wrong era for our stuff. I go, it's space stuff. You can reuse space stuff for other space stuff. Cause what they used in Next Generation, they, you know, and one of the things we used as a guide for season three was the transporter room. I'm like, the transporter room for the Undiscovered Country, it's the same transporter room as Next Generation.
Yeah,
exactly. Yep. I mean, it's like where it's like the same. They didn't like rebuild. It's the same set. They just put a couple things. I go, a transporter room's not going to change in 100 years. Oh, you know, you can reuse and reuse and do different things with anything. So, you know, that's why with our sets, you know, the sick bay looks like an upgraded Voyager sick bay, or a transporter room looks like a transporter room. It's like, let's not reinvent the wheel here, guys, because, you know, we need to do it the cheap, cool way that they did it in the past.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, Dave, you get an A+ from us. Thank you so much for joining us. It's really great, now that the show is over, to be able to talk about how they made, well, not the sausage, I guess the Star Trek, whatever we're going to say. But it's been great having you on the show. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on it. And it's an honor to hang out with you guys. And I would say it's like Star Trek has the best fan base, because they love the details and they love the nerd stuff. And it's like, I remember being on set one day and mentioning like the Badmiral ships that we were going to use in season two, and all the different ship classes. And someone said, "You actually know the name of the ship classes?" I go, "Yes." I go, "And the fans will too." And yeah. It's like, "Oh my God, you're bringing back a steam runner class." It's like, yeah, they no idea. They're like, "Yeah, I didn't even know that they had names." So there you go.
And we can only hope that if
you guys know, and that's the thing. And that's why, you know, Star Trek fans are the best.
Well, we can only hope that if Legacy does see the light of a projector bulb at some point in the future, that you are available and can work on it. Because obviously, like you said, it's between being greenlit, if that does happen, and written, it's a ways off before anything could happen. And we hope you'll be a part of it.
Well, hopefully, you know, it's handy that I happen to live in Toronto now, where they have just greenlit two new Star Trek shows, which would probably be mostly, you know, done, at least the Section 31 movie would be done prior to the beginning of Legacy, if that happens. But
yeah,
you know, my phone could ring. Who knows? but yeah, the strike is kind of making things challenging for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, Dave. Well, thanks again, and I'm sure we'll have you back in
the future. Thanks so much. This was a lot of
fun. We'll see you on the road.
All right.
Well, that was great. Dave was a great guest.
Yeah, totally. He's a good egg, and you know, like I said, I had worked on a couple other projects before with him remotely, and we only got to meet on Picard in person.
All kidding aside, I love to hear how much he appreciated you and what esteem he had for you, unlike the other people on the show.
It's entirely mutual, and I enjoyed working for him and with him and all that sort of stuff.
But the respect he you know, we talk about standing on the shoulder of giants, and the respect that he showed for what Mike Okuda and Doug and you brought to Star Trek over the years was really nice to hear. You know, it meant a lot. I was really glad to hear that.
I just love that you know, the legacy is not ignored. Yeah. I'll not be ignored.
And I have to say, Mike has always been very generous with me when I needed help. Even I had a very low budget on Pandora. You know, he was the first person to offer his services as reactivated. And also, you know, he was a really helpful to me on our Greatest Geek Year Ever, 1982, which was just announced today by the CW, be airing this summer on the CW. So we're very excited about over 4 weeks. And Mike contributed to that, as did Darren, who was in the documentary. So I'm very excited to share that with people. Well, you don't live here anymore.
I left.
You moved away.
I abandoned you.
You abandon us.
I'll say this about Dave. I think a guy like that should work forever, and I'll tell you why. I think that what he did on Picard season 3 was great, not just because he loved Star Trek. The way that he talked about his design process, asking the questions, why would it look like that? Look at the historical timeline. What would actually be there? To me, those are the most important questions that a production designer should be asking of his design teams, right? That's what you should be thinking about as a producer. Even like just those little details can mean so much. They tell so much story. And the fact that he just grasps that on an intuitive level comes through. And I just I can't get over. I mean, I just want to go back and rewatch the show again just to see all the things that I can find. Hey, is that a chair from Devil's Due? I doubt it, but wouldn't it be great if it were?
Ashley, you got to admit, I mean, obviously, you know, we both, some of the most important hires on a show are obviously your DP and your production designer. And I think, I know speaking for myself, I work with some great production designers and some really not so great production designers. And it's always a pleasure to have somebody like Dave, like, you know, leading the charge. He just really remarkable. I'd love to have the opportunity to work with him in the future.
Same.
Yeah, yeah,
but one of the things that he mentioned about those palettes, those freezer palettes, all of that stuff back on Next Generation and later were provided by this one guy in L.A. Who had this company called it had a strange like antiseptic name to it. It was like you know, Production Services Incorporated, something like that. But he was known
Star
as
base operations.
He was known as Rocky Fry, the rubber guy. Because he had all these plastic,
that's my porn name.
These plastic parts and giant bins and giant tanks, all made out of plastic, that he would rent to productions. And he was there all the time. And he was, you know, all his stuff was ubiquitous throughout all TV and a bunch of movies. And he passed away, and I hadn't heard anything about that stuff anymore. And it's a great loss, actually.
Yeah. Well, this was terrific, and another great guest from Star Trek Picard, and many more to come as well. And we got some great guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. And of course, we'll be joined by a bunch of great guests as our Inglourious Live Tour continues. We'll be in San Diego Comic-Con the end of July, and then a week later, we'll be in Raleigh.
Very good.
Yeah. Raleigh, North Carolina. With some fabulous guests, followed by the Las Vegas 57-year mission convention. And then, of course, a month later, we'll be in Austin. And yeah, we have some really great guests lined up, some great surprises. For more information, you can go to galaxycon.com or creationint.com for Vegas, or comic-con.org for the great mother of all conventions, Mother of Dragons, San Diego Comic Con, and we really hope we'll see you at one or all of these fine conventions.
Breaker of chains.
Breaker of chains.
Orderer of Starbucks.
Well, I mean, my Dave was funny because he was saying I'd like to do more of these conventions, but you know, it's like I can't just be traveling. It's like, yeah, well, neither can we unless somebody's paying to do it. Yeah. So, which we're happy to do if we, you know,
that's the secret. If you want to get the Trekspurts to your convention, just pay the way.
Well, I'm just going to say, people keep asking. They're like, how do I get you at my convention? It's like, it's very simple. You don't have to call our agent.
Because we have no money to do this.
Well, I'm not going to spend money to do it. I'll tell you that. So, but if they make us an offer, and if everything is taken care of properly and professionally, we'd be happy to come to your convention.
And there are no green M&Ms in the bowl.
I have very specific expectations of what I to be in the green room and what food and bottled water I want.
We want large bread so that we don't have to keep folding it.
If you can meet my very specific requests, including no eye contact from the staff, I will be very happy to join you for your future conventions.
Oh dear, the secret's out.
But you know, there is a writer's strike, so it would be a good time to book us right now.
We got plenty of time.
We got plenty of time, and could use the extra money. So,
wow.
I'm just being honest. No, this was great. It was great having Dave on, and thank you everybody for joining us. And if you want to join the Trekspurts adventure every week, you know where to find us. But you can also get our bonus podcast, the great Deck 78, with a lot of super guests and super guests at TrekspurtsPlus.com. That's TrekspurtsPlus.com, where you can subscribe and get special bonus material and bonus podcasts. And you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Inglourious Trek and Inglourious Treksperts, respectively. And but we'll be back. We'll be back next week. So on behalf of Ashley Edward Miller, Darren Doctorman, and myself, Mark A. Altman, I'm only half kidding about that stuff. We'll see you next week. Until then, keep on trekking. Ingloriously, of course.
Promos in 3, 2, 1.
Darren, it's so exciting. The Inglorious Live Tour 2023 is continuing. And with the lead singer, me, and on guitar, it's Darren Doctorman. And on drums, it's Ashley Edward Miller. What a band.
Sometimes I like to switch to drums occasionally and just, push Ashley off to the side.
Well, we're thrilled because we are having such a great time around these wonderful United States. And it's only because we haven't been invited to Europe yet.
It's our mostly live tour.
It's our mostly live tour. And it's been terrific. And we're going to be, we go every year. It's been a long tradition. We'll be back at the San Diego Comic-Con July 19th through the 23rd. And of course, we're looking forward to bringing the great Starship Smackdown back to San Diego. Then the following week, July 27th to the 30th, we're going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina. Did I say that right?
Or Raleigh.
Oh, okay. One day I'll get it right. We're going to
rally to pronounce Raleigh correctly.
We're not the only ones. Guardian of the Galaxy, Karen Gillan will be there. Charlie Cox from the Daredevil himself. Paul Wesley, who you know and love from Vampire Diaries.
That's right.
Ian Somerhalder also. Stephen Amell. He did not fail the city. He's going to be there. And Billy Dee Williams. Will he have any Colt 45?
That'll be exciting.
Oh,
look who we have here.
That's right. You surely belong with us here in North Carolina.
In Raleigh.
Find out if the gas mining business is really starting to pay off. Marina Sirtis will be there, feeling great joy and gratitude for her invitation. John DeLancey, coming off his spectacular cameo appearance in Picard. I think people are going to have a lot of questions for the great John DeLancey. Brent Spiner will be there. Gates McFadden, Denise Crosby. Will Friedle.
It's gonna be a hoot.
It's gonna be a hoot. But you know what? I'm most excited about, and I'm sure we'll be doing the Q&A with him for our first Q&A with him. Todd Stashwick.
Nice.
No. Yes. Yes. No. I'm therefore going anyway. That's gonna be great. He's hitting the convention circuit big time, and I think people are really excited to see him. So I know we are.
And he's selling t-shirts.
Is he?
I think so.
Okay. Now, if you missed us in San Diego and you missed us in North Carolina, guess where we're going to be the next weekend?
Next weekend is something big.
Yeah, it is. It's the 57-year mission convention in Las Vegas, Nevada, with our friends at Creation Entertainment. August 3rd through the 6th.
That's going to be a big one.
Yeah, that's going to be big because I think it's a lot of excitement about Star Trek after Picard season 3. So people are going to be there and they're going to be excited. Hopefully, it would see all these. I can't even begin to list everyone that's going to be there. It's quite a bit of people. But
I'm trying to arrange some karaoke time.
What?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about.
Karaoke time.
I'm trying to get involved with some karaoke with people we know.
Oh, okay. I just got it. Okay. The following month, we're going to be in Austin, Texas, the great Austin, Texas. Don't mess with Texas. September 1st through the 3rd. Once again, Ashley Miller will be joining us. And the great Jonathan Frakes will be there along with many other members of the cast. Our favorite person in the
Another great Galaxy Con.
Yeah. And Bill Shatner, of course, will be there. Giancarlo Esposito. Brett Basinger from from Stargirl. Chris Sarandon from Fright Night. Nice. And I don't know how I'm going to not get away with not bringing my son, because Matt Lanter, who plays Anakin on the Clone Wars, and James Arnold Taylor, who plays Obi-Wan, are both going to be there. I think Isaac is going to be demanding. I demand it that I bring him to Austin. We'll see what happens.
I just want to keep walking by the Obi-Wan actor's booth and just say, hello there. Just keep doing it all weekend.
That sounds great. Well, if you want more information about any of these conventions or Columbus, Ohio, December 1st through the 3rd, go to galaxycon.com, galaxycon.com, where you can find out more of these great GalaxyCon conventions. If you're interested in San Diego, comiccon.org, and of course, creationent.com for Las Vegas, Nevada. We hope to see you at one or all of these shows in the coming months. And until then, on behalf of Darren, Ashley Miller, and myself, keep on trekking all the way to North Carolina, ingloriously, of course. Okay.